presenting The Follies of the Air, starring Fanny Bryce and James.
Starting around 1880 in the Twin Cities, before there was television or motion pictures, the major form of working class entertainment came from variety theater forms like vaudeville and vaudeville's bawdier cousin, burlesque. Today, the Twin Cities is still home to many kinds of variety theater, including groups that stay true to traditional forms and groups that use variety to explore the range of what's possible on stage. Join me, Michelle Ali Marotti,
and me, Judith McKenzie,
as we take you from the past to the present state of variety theater in the Twin Cities and explore how the Twin Cities took what started as a booming commercial form and transformed it into something uniquely personal, experimental, and even underground.
Large theaters on Hennepin Avenue with the State Theater and the Hennepin Orpheum.
Bob Boucher is a 93-year-old from Minneapolis. He started in vaudeville when he was only 10 years old.
In the Century, in the RKO 7th Street Theater, and then further down there was a Palace on 4th and Hennepin.
Many of the theaters that still stand on Hennepin Avenue today used to house classic vaudeville and burlesque acts that were performed by both local and national artists.
That became the Allen Theater, a burlesque house. The first show that I worked was the summer of 1927. They would bring the kiddies in and do a whole show and another four or five acts of vaudeville with the kiddies.
Because of its location along the railroads, the Twin Cities became a major market for popular variety theater.
And we used to do four or five shows a day, depending on the day of the week. The weekend, of course, were the big hitters, and they got all the crowd in.
Up your glasses and have fun.
The vaudeville form was extremely popular, so much so that acts performed several times a day. They even sometimes did what was called continuous vaudeville, where performances would continue in a cycle all day. Vaudeville was known for being dynamic, even episodic. It was like changing the channel after each act.
We promise you music and drama and fun, so settle yourself and you better be quick, for the curtain is rising on scene number one.
All the kids were probably 10 years old or thereabouts, and they all had some particular style of entertainment. And they would come out and perform and do their act and contribute to the overall show.
Patrick Scully, founder of Patrick's Cabaret in Minneapolis, describes his variety-style cabarets as contemporary vaudeville. He compares the appeal of coming to variety shows to a mystery grab bag.
There are some people who have told me they came and come to Patrick's Cabaret because it reminds them in the old days if you could go into Woolworths and for a dollar get this grab bag. And you didn't know what was going to be in the bag. But I think vaudeville, in most people's minds, carries the sense that this is not one actor or one artist or one group even doing the whole night. This is going to change things up.
Bob Boucher's specialty was acrobatics, but he got his start in music when he was still in kindergarten.
The teacher was an actual dance teacher by the name of Irma Lyons, and she came over to the Harriet Beecher Stowe School in Minneapolis, and in a kindergarten class, we had a kid band that were playing things like cymbals and tempo blocks, and they picked me out of the crowd and put me up and gave me a wand and told me to direct the band.
Later, Bob performed in a Christmas revue at the Pantages Theater. This is where he got his start in acrobatics.
In Christmas of 1927, they had the kid review, and they used the Santa Claus theme. And the big Santa Claus was the individual by the name of Clyde Snyder. And Clyde was about 17 or 18, and I was about 10 at that time, in 27. He'd go out on stage as Santa Claus, and he'd bring a big bag with him. He'd put the bag down on the stage and open up the drawstring, and out popped the little Sandy. And guess who that was? Yours truly.
Lloyd Brandt is co-founder of Theater of Fools, a local vaudeville company based out of the Twin Cities. Lloyd also got his start with acrobatics routines. He explains how physically demanding it is to be a vaudevillian acrobat.
In my 20s, I was drawn to the Buster Keaton style of performing bone-crushing slapstick. That's what I loved. I remember touring nationally, and every show I would put on knee braces and knee pads to survive till the next day. I used to do backflips, you know, bone crushing slapstick on, you know, all kinds of things. And I said to myself, you know, the slapstick has to be edited out of my show if I'm going to make this my life career. So by the time I was 30, I'd cut out all of the slapstick and intensive acrobatics.
Bob's act was also physically demanding, as he describes from his room at Walker Methodist in Minneapolis.
So we did a challenge number. He would do a step, and then I would do a step. And we'd repeat one another's act in that style. And then we'd do a cartwheel for a finish. And it was all the more amazing because Clyde was about 180 or 90 pounds, a big fellow. And I was about maybe 80 or something like that. A normal 8-year-old kid or 7-year-old kid. That was the start of the whole ugly mess.
Many aspects of vaudeville were from a stock repertoire, including everything from the acts themselves to the theater buildings. One of Bob's biggest successes came when he was picked up from a role in a stock act.
I had a call from a fellow that used to do an act with Rudy Valli. They called her act Mirth and Mac. And Leo was my partner, and he taught me the act. And we did the same act for many years with the local theaters and clubs.
The Twin Cities was also home to one of the Schubert Theaters, another stock area of the vaudeville business. Lance Brockman, an associate professor of theater at the University of Minnesota, explains.
The Schubert Theater was owned by the Schuberts, although they really never owned their own theaters. They always would find some local person who would literally front the theater, and they would put their name on it and give them a cut of the money, and they would also set the circuit. So they would set what shows went into that theater. They spec'd everything in that theater, all the way down to the wattage of the light bulbs that went around the makeup mirrors, because that was all about money.
The Minneapolis Schubert Theater was originally located on 7th Street in downtown in the current location of Block E, but has since moved to Hennepin Avenue. Lance says at the time of the relocation, it was the largest building to be moved intact in the Twin Cities. The Schubert is currently being renovated and will soon reopen as a dance theater. Another stock aspect of vaudeville was the scenic drops. In the early 1900s, if you saw a vaudeville show, there was a good chance that the backdrop was made in the Twin Cities. Lance talks about one of the largest local vaudeville scenic studios.
In the cities, there was Twin Cities Scenic Studios, which is probably the largest and certainly the only one where there's really good artifacts that has survived. But there were many studios that went in competition with each other where scenery was produced here. And then through the train mechanism, most of them were used to create the environments that were then shipped out west.
Minnesota was often first to follow with the latest trends bursting out of both Chicago and New York. This was because of the Twin Cities' proximity to each other. Lloyd Brandt talks about how vaudeville producers capitalize on the fact that Twin Cities residents rarely traveled between the sister cities.
To this day, Minneapolis and St. Paul have completely different personalities. And so these vaudevillians, they literally, you know, could spend several weeks in one region performing into these two major markets. When they played when a vaudevillian played the Minneapolis Orpheum, nobody from St. Paul went because they're coming next week to St. Paul. I just remember seeing reviews of the Marx Brothers where they, and I can't remember which it was, whether they died in Minneapolis and they killed in St. Paul, or they died in St. Paul and they kill. Either you die or you kill. You know, this is a negative and a positive. I don't know why. But that's the way we, you know, vaudevillians talk. It's like, oh, I killed today, or I slayed him, or, oh, I died that last show. Oh, my God.
The dueling markets in the Twin Cities also raised the pressure to have bigger and better spectacle, which led to the construction of larger venues. The largest house in the Twin Cities is the 3,000-seat Paramount Theater in St. Paul, which lies vacant today. Another large space in the Twin Cities was the Minneapolis Auditorium. Lance Brockman talks about the spectacular acts that the auditorium could house.
They would literally flood the floor and freeze it so they could do spectacle pieces that in the second act there would be ice skating. And they would lay on the top of the ice these pads that were covered with grass to make it look like it's a different time of the year, and then at the intermission break they pull all this off to reveal the ice, just like they do at the XL Center, to do these ice skating routines.
Look!
Yes, Daddy?
Come here at once.
Here I am, Daddy.
Why didn't you come when I called you?
I didn't hear you the first two times.
The Twin Cities even had a do-it-yourself movement in vaudeville's heyday. By hosting giant pageants, the local residents proved that variety was not only for the professionals. Lance explains.
There were all of these public pageants. You know, there's this sort of shift that occurs after the turn of the century where people want to do this on their own, even though they're not trained and they're not actual performers. And there's one that I can think of, and I can't recall the date, but it's in the mid-teens. It was done when the Chain of the Legs, which means connecting Harriet and Lake of the Isles, occurred. That was a huge event. That was a lagoon that connected those two things together, but more importantly, they did these incredible stagings on Lake of the Isles. And one thing that they did is they had a parade of boats. So they had boats that representing the conquest of America or whatever, and they would have the Mayflower, and they would have Leif Erikson's arrival, and these were all done in very small boats. And then on the island, they would do some Native American experience, which I don't think was very politically correct, but they would literally fill the whole island as a performance space, and the people would come in the summers and sit on the banks to watch this. So I think that public pageants were unique in the fact that they almost always referenced local history.
Lloyd Brandt shares the story of the first vaudeville performances in Minneapolis.
The very first vaudeville performance ever was in Minneapolis on Main Street, right near what's now River Place and St. Anthony, Maine. There was a little vaudeville theater there, and the Millers, all the workers from the flour mills came down and saw the vaudeville performances down there. I believe in the 1880s was the first live vaudeville performance.
We are calling on someone whose name stands for laughter. Be ready.
Shows usually had to hit big in New York or Chicago before they would tour, but one of vaudeville's biggest circuits was set by two men in St. Paul's historic Ham building. Those men were Moses Finkelstein and Isaac Rubin. Finkelstein and Rubin later built two of the Twin Cities' biggest theaters, the Paramount Theater in St. Paul and the State Theater in Minneapolis. But the Keith Orpheum circuit was perhaps the biggest national vaudeville circuit in the U.S. The Twin Cities was unique in that it was the only metropolitan area that had two Orpheum theaters. Gene Foreman Christ is a former vaudevillian tap dancer who toured the Orpheum circuit. Jean shares her fondest memories of working the Orpheum circuit.
I played St. Paul many, many times with different bands. Every band we went played there because I did the whole Orpheum circuit. If you had one there, I played it.
Well, good evening. It feels so wonderful to be back amongst you and here on the Orpheum stage again.
There was a dance that we created, and it was called the Big Apple, and it became very, very famous. And this was in 1937. Everyone was doing square dancing, and we wanted to do something different, something with the new modern steps. And so you get in a circle, and you do all the modern steps. And so when it became so famous, Gail Foster, who was head of the Roxy Theater in New York, came down south to find out who the original dancers were, and she brought us back to New York. Then I was spotted by a producer and asked to be featured in a Hollywood nightclub in New York, and I was only 15 years old, but they didn't realize it at the time. After 3 months at the nightclub, we went on tour in the vaudeville.
Jean has many amazing stories from her 7.5 years in vaudeville, but she recalled her favorite memory as when she met her dance idol, Eleanor Powell.
I was in dancing school, but we didn't work with our heels the way Eleanor Powell did. And so I would go to the movies on Saturday early in the morning, the first movie, just to watch her dance. And then I would go home and work the steps with as many heel sounds as I could get. And so when I started doing vaudeville, I also became friends with a man. His name was Maury Amsterdam. One time we were going to be at the Orpheum Theater in Chicago. And when we arrived at our hotel, there was a note for me saying, I've got a big surprise for you. So I got a newspaper, and then immediately I knew what the surprise was. It was that he was at the Chicago Theater working with Eleanor Powell, and he knew that I loved her so much, and I knew he was going to introduce me. So what happened is Eleanor Powell closed. She was the big star act, and we opened our show. And so I would have a taxi cab waiting, and the cab would take me from the our theater over to the Chicago theater that she was working at. And the doorman would let me ride in, and Eleanor would sweep by me, and she'd go out and dance. And as she would dance, I would cry. I was so excited. And so finally she came off, and Maury introduced us. And so she looked at me, and she said, "What steps do you want to learn?" And here she's all sweaty, and she came off, went into the wings, and started teaching me. And this was after the second day, and we were there 7 days. And she taught me after every single show.
Bob Boucher also shared a story of meeting a vaudeville headliner here in Minneapolis, dance legend Bill Robinson.
I met him in 1933 at the Hennepin Orpheum Theater. He'd make a deal with the manager and tell him I want to teach some dancing classes to the dancing teachers in town, and I want to use their theater, and that'll be part of my deal with you. And he used the Spitzole shoes, which were the a wooden sole shoe with wooden heels, and he got a mellow sound out of that, and that's what contributed to his style. He didn't use metal plates like the common dancers did.
Vaudeville brought to the forefront some of the most impeccable performers that the stage has seen to date, but the industry was tough and often dangerous. But Jean says that even the most dangerous acts dare not miss a show.
Heaven help you if you ever missed a show, because they wanted to kill you, the other acts. They were so angry. It was like, I can't even tell you. There's nothing on, you could kill somebody and they wouldn't be as mad as if you missed a show. And I missed two in my lifetime, and I really suffered from both of them.
Many times, the dangers in vaudeville came from producers constantly competing for the latest onstage spectacle. But the competition for spectacle also brought about advances in technology for other sectors of society. Lance Brockman talks about a particularly important contribution.
It was the first use of electricity in cities. Everyone always thinks electricity was a public utility, but in the beginning, in most cities, electricity was because of its technological excesses for use in production. So in the basement of the Bijou Theater was a dynamo that would create electricity, which they would use at night. Then during the day, they would sell it up and down the block for various vendors.
There were as many types of variety acts as there were theaters to perform them in. But the most popular were comedy skits, dance, and acrobatics. and singing acts. And though vaudeville was the more mainstream variety form, some of the best vaudeville performers could also be seen performing burlesque. Today, burlesque is often misconstrued as simply a striptease, but in the late 19th and early 20th century, the performances were much more varied. Bob Boucher and Jean Christ weigh in on the differences between burlesque and vaudeville.
Vaudeville, of course, was a family-oriented thing, and you shouldn't have gotten so bawdy or really anti-religious.
When you think of vaudeville, you think of different types of acts that are in a variety show. And so burlesque was the same form of vaudeville. They had different types of acts, only they were risque. Milton Berle and Jackie Gleason and many of the famous comedians actually started in burlesque, and some of them switched back and forth.
Nadine Dubois is a contemporary burlesque performer in the Twin Cities. Her company, Lily's Burlesque Review, got its start in the Minnesota Fringe Festival, and now, years later, has a monthly show. Nadine describes what burlesque means to her.
Burlesque, in the modern sense, the nouveau movement, so to speak, is a modern embodiment of a historical art. So back years and years ago, even in the 1800s when this art first started, it was all about parody, all about funny, and then moving on to including showgirls in the mix. Now doing this modern form, we're using that same formula, using live music, variety, novelty acts, lots of comedy, and featuring these strip teasers or ecdysias in the show. We like to say that we sell the sizzle and not the steak. So there's a return to innocence, there's a fun and playfulness about it, and a beauty as well.
Nadine explains the acts you'll see in any given installment of the Underpants show.
It's in a variety show format. So little vignettes that are all introduced and talked about by me. There's beautiful singers. We have novelty acts like physical comedians, fire artists, jugglers, anything that kind of fits into that vaudevillian tradition. And then finally leading up to the burlesque dancers. And we'll have, you know, more than one in a show happening more than once during the show, doing anything from a classic Sally Rand fan dance to a tribute to Michael Jackson with a dancing machine and, you know, lots of shimmying and shaking and fun, hula hooping, but most of all, lots of beauty and lots of laughs during a show.
Nadine is one of many contemporary performers who has found a way to make variety theater her own. Patrick Scully also weighs in on how contemporary variety theater in the Twin Cities has been utilized to support less commercial ventures.
I think that in the Twin Cities, we're fortunate to have created an environment that through Patrick's Cabaret, through Balls, through the Fringe Festival, that has facilitated artists being able to get their work on stage without lots of hoops to jump through or hurdles to get over. And I think that's a good thing. I think that we have created here a kind of grassroots access that encourages people who aren't professional artists to think, well, what do I have to say?
Patrick believes the most important aspect of the artistic platform he has created is the elimination of auditions. This is a giant break away from traditional vaudeville, where artists were constantly asked to prove themselves.
That was, I think, a new thing that I brought to the mix with all of that, was to very consciously say, there are no auditions. That was definitely a radical step to take here in this community. And people are like, well, what do you mean there's no audition? I mean, how do you know if what I'm going to do is any good or not? And I would just look at somebody and say, well, you know, frankly, that's more your worry than mine, because I've got five other acts on stage that night. And so if you're really bad, the others are going to just look that much better in comparison.
Lloyd Brandt has also made a conscious decision to personalize his style of variety theater, but he and his show partner Rosie Cole still perform with reverence to historic acts. Lloyd recently produced and directed the 100th anniversary show at the Southern Theater, remembering the very first act to grace the century-old stage. When Lloyd began to research the show, he found some uncanny similarities to his own career in vaudeville.
The Southern Theater opened in 1910, and the very first show that they presented was a vaudeville show. And they approached me to create a vaudeville show for their 100th anniversary. So I went back and I found archives of the original vaudeville show, and it was haunting for me because the only woman on the bill was named Rose, and I'm like, well, my wife's name Rosie. Oh my God. And then another act on the bill was this clown juggling act with this mechanical pool table, and my old juggling partner Arsene is a pool shark. At the time, was developing the W.C. Field mechanical pool table, and so I'm like, oh my God. And then the song and dance acts describe this other group that we brought in called the Medicine Show. So we literally were able to recreate the very first vaudeville show presented at the Southern.
One fact about vaudeville is still unclear, and that's, when did vaudeville actually die out? This is because vaudeville was gradually absorbed into up-and-coming electronic forms like film, radio, and later on, television.
Oh, I wonder what the poor people are doing tonight.
The second act of Lloyd's show at the Southern not only encompassed this idea, but also made modern parallels.
We first did the first vaudeville show, and then the second half was as if all of these performers came back at the end of vaudeville, and what were they like? What were the challenges that they had? We brought in the idea that radio was live vaudeville, and that movies were pushing out live performers as well. And so one of the acts became a movie star and was coming back, and so you saw, you know, that arc. And then we had a radio playing at the time. And I thought, boy, the parallels between the death of vaudeville and now, our modern times, all the challenges were haunting to me because the electronic media was what was affecting the decline of vaudeville. And here we have nobody's buying CDs. You know, television, broadcast television is being challenged by new technology of the internet. And so really fascinating parallels.
But there's a quality to live variety theater that will never be replaced by technology. There's a certain magic that you only get from a live show.
The vaudeville performer walks out on stage and looks the audience directly in the eye. And you don't get that in the movies. You don't get that on television. You are getting a direct connection with the artist on stage. And that is what's the magic of vaudeville.
What about you, Michelle? Do you believe in the magic?
Yes, Judith, there is definitely a magical quality to a live performance.
I believe in that magic, too.
It's a good thing.
We'd like to give special thanks to Martha Johnson, Christopher Yeager, Lance Beneshek, Scott Crosby, David Cummings,
and to our interviewees, Lloyd Brandt, Lance Brockman, Nadine Dubois, Patrick Scully, Bob Boucher, and Jean Foreman Christ. Thanks for your help in putting this together.
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.